This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. For those who may not know me, I am actually Zach and Josh's dad. But we haven't really planned on anything necessarily, but I'll let Steve jump in because I have a surprise.
Not until pinball actually became legal again in New York City in 1976, as well as Chicago and Los Angeles at that time. And as the story goes, Roger more than helped in the picture over there with that nice bushy mustache and long hair. And I noticed this odd-looking character every night playing pinball, as it is with me and customers that I become familiar with. I started chatting with them and found out that there was a world of pinball that I had no idea about. And Roger started schooling me. Now, in our...
Well, I'm going to interrupt for a second. All right, let me go back because we're looking at about 30 years. And one of the things that you have to understand and hopefully appreciate is that, you know, there are different odd couples that have existed over the years. You think of Rob and Mike and Oscar and Felix, for those who remember the odd couple, maybe Abbott and Costello. I mean, this bromance, if you will, was really based on pinball. And, you know, when I moved to New York City after really discovering pinball in Wisconsin when I was in school, there was no pinball. Steve's Arcade, which was the world-famous Broadway arcade on 52nd Street in the heart of Manhattan, actually had some games that Williams and Gottlieb had produced back in 1972. One was Zodiac, one was Planets. They were allowed in because of Bess Meyerson allowing in that type of pinball that did not have bumpers, did not have a plunger. There was a spinner in the middle. You basically pressed the button on top, the ball came up. There were a row of targets in the very back, top part of the play field, and that was the game. And Steve's Arcade, different than some of the others that were in Midtown, actually had games there that kind of emulated pinball, so I wound up hanging out there. This is, you know, we're looking at around 1972, 1973, until I found a place that was a peep show that had pinball machines. So, I mean, I wanted to give just a reference point to, look, I've been around it now for 40 years. I was thinking about that the other day, and it kind of just astounded me because the years have really piled up in terms of when I really got started. And it was a selfish desire that I wanted a pinball machine, and that result is a book that I guess has endured for a while, the opportunity to testify in New York, but more importantly with all of that, and I take great pride in what Josh and Zach have done, it's allowed me to remain incredibly close with my dear friend. We have gone through a lot of stuff. We may not always agree on things, but I think that part of that friendship was really responsible for how we developed Papa and what the motivation was behind that. And if there's curiosity about that, we can get into it. That goes back to 1978. Us being roped back in with the reestablishment of the IFPA. So pinball has kind of been a defining point for us. More importantly, and I want to stress it, what Steve was able to accomplish at the Broadway Arcade was remarkable. I'm hoping that if there's some curiosity, maybe he'll even share a few stories with some of the regulars there who were relatively famous, celebrities. I even see one on a wall over there standing next to his Stern pinball machine, who used to come into the Broadway Arcade. It became a home away from home for people wanting to play pinball from different backgrounds. And Steve was always there as our host. I mean, gracious to a fault. We would stay late and play games endlessly, trying to determine who was better, who was best, trying to figure out what the new games were when the new games came in, and there's a story behind that as well. But I think what's more miraculous, and I'll do a plug right now, anybody who ever gets to New York City, if you're not planning on going, you have to go. You have to go to 26th and 3rd. You have to see what Steve and all of his associates have been able to achieve with Modern Pinball NYC on 26th and 3rd. It is amazing. In this day and age where it's difficult to find places that have a few machines, let alone a few machines that are working, you're looking at a location that has 33 machines that are in top-notch shape. And you have a person right here who wants to welcome you into that home. And I think that, again, it's a tribute to the fact that Steve's life has been defined by pinball going back to his dad, but he has remained pure and true with it. So I just want to share that, and I'll let Steve get back to whatever the hell he was talking about.
Well, thank you, Roger. But all that doesn't happen unless I meet up with this strange-looking guy playing pinball in my store. I really did not have a sense of what pinball was. And I played it as a child. At 7, 8 years old, I started playing. My dad actually managed an arcade in Newark at the time. And it was something that was fascinating and wonderful to do and very self-fulfilling, even at that age, to be able to accomplish all these little goals that this little machine had set out for me. But again, being in this New York and not having pinball for 12, 13 years, I kind of just got away from it, and then all of a sudden it reemerged. And it reemerged at a point where Roger was there and to help me really move to another level as far as operating a pinball arcade and an amusement arcade. And the Broadway arcade was video and pinball, but the pinball part of it was special.
Well, in the beginning, it wasn't so special. I think that I started writing for Playmeter magazine. It's one of the trade magazines back in 1975. And I used to go out to test locations. And the test locations, by and large, whether it was Playmatic, Bally, Williams, Gottlieb, at the time, I would have to drive down to New Jersey, sometimes down to the New Jersey shore. And I was living in Manhattan. And we're looking at, you know, a 2 or 3 hour drive to go play a game for a while. And then a 2 or 3 hour drive back just so I could write about these machines that were out for the first time on test. And selfishly, again, with Steve and I becoming friendlier, all I pointed out to him, because they were, you know, they had older games back then. There were no new machines that were in New York City. I mean, the place was just kind of opening up. You had Hubert's Museum on 42nd Street. The big thing for that was live ammunition shooting gallery. You had Playland that was in between on 47th near where the Tickets place is now in Midtown. You had another Playland across the street. You had another place on 42nd Street. I mean, I can go off the list off of basically one hand in Midtown Manhattan, and there was a place that I actually started playing down the Village, which was a record store, where they had three games in the back that were obviously against the law to play, and it was actually the inspiration for Sharpshooter by playing Free Fall / Sky Jump, for those who remember the old Gottlieb game from 1975. But, you know, I approached Steve with the idea, because by that point I had already been to a couple of trade shows, I already knew some people. Talked to him about becoming a test location so that I didn't have to, there's an Italian expression, schlep miles upon miles upon miles. And it's something that, you know, thank God Steve actually stepped up. I'll let him continue, but it wasn't the easiest thing for him to be able to achieve to do that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad Roger is admitting to the fact that he needed a space that he could go to without traveling. I mean, that was not revealed to me when he started this whole idea of me trying to get the space as a test location. The history is that my dad had a partner, a silent partner. His name was Albert Simon. And Albert Simon Incorporated was the largest distributor of amusement games on the East Coast.
I'll interject again, just historical reference, and I know we're going beyond 30 years of chronicling. The power brokers in the 30s on the East Coast included Al Simon, and Al Simon was the major distributor for Williams back through the 60s and 70s and 80s, actually. A fellow by the name of Irving Kay and a fellow by the name of Irving Green. those three guys basically controlled the entire East Coast. And that was with every type of vending machine, forgetting about pinball, just everything. Whatever they said went. So.
Now, not knowing that and being naive pretty much to the whole world of politics and who was who in the industry, I just approached Mr. Simon with the idea that we might benefit more if we had the exposure to other games than Bally and Gottlieb. And for some strange reason, he was able to see through that and allow me to approach the manufacturers and distributors with the concept of testing games at Broadway Arcade. And that was accomplished. So that opened up an incredibly new world for me because I had been very local to New Jersey and New York. I had never traveled. I really never saw the world of what was going on in pinball until I became associated with the other manufacturers, was able to go out to trade shows where I was introduced to everyone through Roger. Now, Roger had some panache at the time and was considered the golden boy. You know, had written this book. He wasn't really in the industry, but he was very, very well respected for his writing and his perception about pinball. So it was incredibly a door-opening experience that I delved and jumped into head first and was rewarded immensely. Immensely in the fact that I was able to get myself immersed into the pinball community. I met incredible designers. It was Steve Ritchie around, who at the time was a young man like us.
Speak for yourself.
Well, whatever. and you know, Jimmy Patla and I also was able to meet, at that time, Harry Williams, Bill Gersh. I was able to meet Norm Clark. So, in a sense, I was able to understand the history and bridge with Roger an era that was from the 30s to the 70s. I also was able to become a designer because of Roger. Got a game out called Barracora that Roger and I both did. Did help a little bit with Sharpshooter, but it allowed me to experience pinball in many, many different levels other than just operating a game.
Kind of like Cisco and Pancho.
Maybe.
So anyway, I mean, look, admittedly, there has been what I think of as an incredible transformation with pinball. You know, I lived and died during the Williams era. Going back to, you know, the mid-70s on through to 1999, seeing Gary being the only man standing for about 10 years and then Jersey Jack coming on board. And the part that I find remarkable today with, you know, what John Papaduke is doing and Barry and all these other people from around the world, basically, to me, if you go back historically, to me it harkens back to the 1930s. When you had, you know, basically families working out of garages. You know, if Michael Gottlieb were here, I'm sure that he could talk about his grandfather, David Gottlieb, and the family with David's brothers, Alvin Gottlieb being a young boy, you know, getting pieces of wood and pounding nails in. Ray Maloney starting up Bally in 1931 from Lion Manufacturing. Harry Williams, you know, as a young man during the Depression, wanting to be a Disney animator, and instead finding himself at a sales pitch with some guy pitching the West Coast and wanting to know if anybody was interested in operating pinball machines. And as Harry told me, he jumped right up and ran to the front and said, yes, I'll do it. And the rest, as they say, is really, you know, history in terms of what his impact is. So you have people today who have, you know, fresh ideas, new approaches, who are trying to keep an icon. I'm not going to call it a hobby. We're trying to keep the industry of pinball alive because it's meaningful. You know, people have asked me, what do you think over the years? What do you think about pinball? And, you know, will it survive? Where is it going to be in 10 years or whatever? And my pat answer has always been, and whether or not anybody here agrees with it, it's always been, until I can find something that replicates this experience and the totality of it, the immersiveness of it, the tactile feeling that I have, until somebody can give me that, in some other medium, in some other form, you know, pinball is still unique. I mean, it's the only thing that really works off of all of our senses, whether we're good players, bad players, sometime players, high-end skilled players. I mean, there's something literally for everyone. And I think the part, and I hope that Steve will touch upon it, is that we're embarking on a whole new era of younger people now being exposed to pinball in a way that they never were before. And I think that what Bobby and Jay at Farsight have done has been remarkable. I think that Zen Studios has done a great job. But it's an emulation. It's not real pinball. And it's not to knock it. I mean, I worked very hard with Farsight to provide approvals and direction and input in terms of the quality of the gameplay that they were presenting. But I think that, again, when it goes back to it, it really is pinball. And places like Modern Pinball, 26th and 3rd, if I didn't say that before, it's 26th and 3rd in Manhattan. Steve and his group are doing parties. I mean, mothers and parents and so on are calling up to say, hi, we'd like to rent out a space so that our children can come for a birthday party. I mean, think about it in the context of the Chuck E. Cheese's out there and the GameWorks out there and all these other places. Here's a place that is absolutely, totally, completely pinball, and he's finding it difficult to find enough time 24/7 to fit in all these special functions, and not just for children, it's for kids and adults. But I'm just saying that here's somebody that is able to do something that is unique and remarkable in this day and age. So I don't know if you wanted to touch on that.
Well, we could go to the present and then hopefully go back to the past, but Modern Pinball, it basically is an offshoot of me becoming aware after the Broadway Arcade closed, and I pretty much went into retirement for a few years, but then became aware of something going on in New York City. And there's a gentleman here, Chris, would you stand up for a second for me? This gentleman, on his own, started competitive pinball in a very incredible way in New York. I was astounded by what he had accomplished. Hundreds and hundreds of players he got going into different bars around the city and just creating an incredible interest. Through a chance meeting, I met a gentleman who calls himself Pinaholic. I don't know if he's around, but could he stand up a second? That's Al Siak. Al is an incredible human being in that he moves around with a disability that would stop half the world, and he gets through it every day because of pinball. And it was because of him and Chris and a few other people that I got to meet in the late, in 2008, 2009, gave me the strength and gave me the excitement back in to try to do something unique. And, you know, with Al's help, we created Modern Pinball. And the purpose of it and the place that we chose was directly resulting in the idea that we needed to expose pinball not to people that have seen it before, but to new audiences. So we went into a residential area, something I was unfamiliar with because I had always been in the Midtown and Broadway, in the, you know, with all the lights and everything. But this was something that it was a big chance. I mean, we all took a deep breath. But it's incredible what has happened. We've only been open a year, and it's amazing how many kids come into this store on weekends. I mean, if you've seen some pictures on Facebook that we post, I mean, we have 30 kids coming in for a party, you know, 10-year-old girls screaming and yelling, running around playing pinball. They've never seen it before. It's amazing that the parents will take their kids into the store, like Roger said, and they'll say to me, this is wonderful because now my kid has a place to go out to where he's not sitting in the house being antisocial and looking at a screen playing a video game. And it's very rewarding at that level. And I don't know where it's going to lead, but I know that if things continue, I just believe that this is an opening and a new era for introducing pinball to a whole new group of people that have never seen it. And if they don't get to play it now, where will it be in 20 years before they can go into a bar and play it? So again, it's kind of a mission. It's kind of a big passion for us, Chris and Al and my other partner, Steve. And, you know, it's a joy almost to go every day and experience something that is new to me. Because at the Broadway Arcade, we never had kids. I mean, it wasn't something that kids came into because we were very restrictive, obviously, and the area we're in did not attract children. But again, who is going to be our new players? If we don't get new players going, what's the future of pinball? And a world without pinball is a very sad place.
Very sad. But anyway, I guess we're looking at 30 years of pinball adventures. I'm going to open up the floor in a couple of moments and see if you guys actually have some questions that might be more relevant than that's just babbling. But I think if you look back at the 30 years, and it's a tribute to Rob and to Mike for what they've been able to accomplish at Pinball Expo when, I'll use the collective we, when we were still a thriving industry. To bring people together, to really expose designers, programmers, some of corporate management over the years to players, to enthusiasts, to operators, to collectors. I take my hat off for what you guys have been able to accomplish. And more importantly, through the times, because look, if we look back 30 years ago to 1984, times were different. That was around the time of a game called Space Shuttle. And prior to that, times were a little bit tough for pinball. Bally was on the balls of its ass. Gottlieb had basically gone out of business. And Gil Pollack, who I know is speaking at some point during the weekend, through Premier Technology, took on the mantle. Williams stayed, obviously, having had Comet before. To kind of resurrect, but pinball was down. It was basically a victim of the surge and bust of video games. So all the video arcades that opened up in malls featuring Pac-Man and Space Invaders and whatever else kind of went by. Everybody had different expectations. I think the expectations have actually been reached if you ever go back historically and look at the Time Magazine pieces and all the rest of what happened in the media talking about video games being the next new entertainment medium. But pinball was kind of like off on its own with a group of people that hadn't really had a chance to play it. All they knew were video games. They went to an arcade, there was no pinball, there was just video. And then they had their Colecos and their Ataris and their Magnavoxes and their Bally arcades. You know, again, history tends to be recyclable. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make for the 30 years of adventure is think back to what has occurred. Late 80s, a remarkable resurgence. I mean, what Data East / Sega / Stern Pinball was able to accomplish. The acquisition in 1988 of Bally Midway by Williams and what the company was able to achieve. Gottlieb. Through Premier, at least, as a brand, doing great things. Capcom coming on the scene for at least a brief period of time. You had something where there was some momentum, and the problem was that momentum wasn't sustainable for a number of reasons. You don't have to delve into it, but again, you go into the early 1990s, and we have games like Twilight Zone and Addams Family and others that tended to define an era. And then you have this dormant period, forgetting about Pinball 2000 for the moment, and you have Gary trying to, you know, take on a different role. And that different role, and I'm not trying to call Gary out, but I remember over a number of years, and Rob probably remembers and cringes, you know, Gary would come out and talk to you guys, and basically he would say, and I know the tune has changed, I don't care about any of you guys. I'm building games for, you know, for the bars and for whatever. Well, he changed. He changed because he understood and realized that all of you are the backbone of what keeps pinball alive. Yes?
My favorite story is Roger Sharp himself. He says, I don't know how much longer Williams can support the show because it's not for the vendors and operators.
Yep. Now, did those words... No. I'm going to answer that. Did those words come out of my mouth? No. They came out of the battles that I had internally because the cost and the expense, and somebody by the name of Neil Nicastro and Ken Fidesna really had a hard time justifying what it was that we were expending when we'd bring 10 or 12 games for the tournament. I don't know if anybody remembers those days where a single manufacturer brought games. God bless Trent and what he's been able to do the last few years, but it used to be on us. And the Jose Delgados and the Jim Sherds of the world and others would come, spend 5 days trying to maintain the games, make sure everything was good. We'd be dealing with our local distributors to make sure that they would be buying the used games at a cost. I mean, everything was out of pocket. And the biggest problem was, yeah, I mean, the market was floundering back in the mid-90s and the late 90s, and it was a question of how do you justify to continue to do this? So it wasn't my thing. Look, for those who go back far enough as part of the 30 years, you may remember Alice and Jeanette, my assistant and her sister, when we used to put packages together of plastics to give everybody. And then I found the next year people were selling the stuff I was giving away for free, and I was like, all right, screw that. It's going to be $5 for the bag. We'll give you a nice assortment. And at least that went back into the kitty to the company to say, look, I am actually able to offset some of the cost for what the company is incurring. But going back to it, I mean, now you get into the 21st century, and we have a whole different look over the last decade as to what's going on. Gary has had, you know, a revelation. He has seen the light at the end of the tunnel and realizes that he needs the entire universe, not just a selected group. You have Jack coming on the scene for whatever the motivation was to try to fill the void, and you have all these other folks that are now stepping up. But the key, again, is your continued support, belief, and hopefully your love affair with pinball. I mean, that's the only thing that really, really, really keeps it going. So,
and the Rob, thank you. Thank you for 30 years of really hard and incredible work. This type of venue. You know, it exposes pinball in many different levels. I have to admit, I've never been a collector. I've never really been a hobbyist. I've been an operator of pinballs. That's how I've looked.
You had machines in your house that you sold. I would never sell any of my games.
That's evident because my room, I'm staying at Roger's house. I've got to sleep with three of them. So, but I'm used to that. I when I first met Roger, actually, he had a studio apartment in Midtown, in 27th Street in Manhattan. And in that, and you have to understand, a New York City studio apartment is basically...
There was an L-shaped room. You walked in and had five pinball machines.
Right. And all his clothes stacked up on it because he had no closet space. So at that point, I really knew that there was a different world of pinball. We look at this in the 30 years or 35 years that we're talking about. The idea of competitive pinball, which has become a very strong part of the Pinball Expo, thanks to Rob's work and now Trent taking up the slack. And there is a big component in that. The competitive pinball aspect for Roger and I, well, from Roger's schooling of me, developed back in the late 70s. And I know that there's a piece in our little... a book that says that I developed a scoring system, which is totally erroneous. Roger, basically, and I played over 10,000 games, which he kept and still has records of, to develop this scoring system.
All handwritten and then typed on sheets, right, because I was a lunatic. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I want to clear that up right away. But we looked at it not as something that, you know, wow, we can go beat up on people. It was really, the whole idea about it was as a marketing tool. A marketing tool the same way that bowling leagues exist to support bowling. And that's how we really approached it.
Kind of. I mean, I'll back up for a second. The motivating factor, Bally Super Shooter Tournament, had over 1 million players compete in Aladdin's Castles back in 1976, 77. It was interesting just to see all the games being played, and it came down to the top 20 players that came out to Chicago. I want to say it was like a February of 1978. I still remember. The age range was 11 to 32, and there was one woman. So they came from different regions to compete for, in quotes, the world championship. I still remember the names. The setup was kind of interesting, and I helped set up the games. I was actually a co-anchor, if you will, going through the play-by-play. For those from Chicago, my cohort on the microphone was a fellow by the name of Gary Meyer, who's become something of an icon, at least in radio here in Chicago. He was just kind of starting out back then. Ken Lunsford won the tournament. Interestingly, Ken was from Plains, Georgia. Little peanut farmer by the name of Jimmy Carter was from Plains, Georgia. We had live coverage there from all the major networks at the Playboy Towers downtown. Ken won by making an extra shot on 8-ball, which was one of the final games against a guy by the name of Joe Grillo, who was just remarkable, played fantastic all weekend. And he wound up by getting one shot, and the way they did the scoring system, he got the 5X for those who know 8-ball, so he made the loop, 5X, just eked it out. He lost, it was 2 out of 3, he lost 2 games to Joe. His last shot gave him more points cumulatively, and Belly awarded him the championship. And I came back, and again, I mean, Steve being the lunatic that he is, along with me, along with a fellow by the name of Lionel Martinez, who was in the film business as a film editor, kind of brought him along, and it was just like, there has to be some type of a scoring system that can be done. There has to be something like a handicapping system that can be done to equalize things so that that kind of situation can happen. And following up with Steve every single day for hours upon hours. And understand, when you see a wall of games, that's what we used to do. Steve, at the end of the day, I'd be at the arcade, and this is, again, 52nd and Broadway. Steve would be doing his collections, and, you know, it's like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would start on a wall. And if Steve was still counting, I'd play one ball, until I got down to whatever games. And at one time, Steve had like 60 or 70 pinball machines. We're not talking about an insignificant number of games. Sometimes he was there with me from the start, and we would play the games together. Sometimes it would be, but it would always be a wall. Net result was, you know, when Papa first started, we put up a wall. Trent is doing it now. IFPA has lots of times where they're doing walls of games, however you want to call it or phrase it. But I think that the big thing that we tried to do, I was obsessed with the idea that there could be some type of a scoring system. 10-5-1, 7-5-3-1. I mean, there had to be some way. And I'm big on acronyms, so PAPA was a Professional and Amateur Pinball Association. Despite what anybody might think, I don't have that large an ego or vanity, so I said it was being basically created by MES International, which was Martinez, Epstein, Sharp. And the thing that I was trying to come up with as a formula was PEBGA, Point Efficiency Per Game Average. And it actually really held. Now, you can't really adapt it and apply it. I'd have to go back through all my sheets and the sheets to Steve's point. We played for about 2 or 3 years easily until it was like enough already. It got a little bit intense. Lionel was not the same caliber of player, so Lionel got a little bit depressed and a little bit frustrated. We did some tryouts. I remember there was a group of kids from one of the colleges who had done a little documentary with me, and it was just like, "Hi, can you guys come by on a Sunday morning and we're going to do something. I just want to try this out." One of the first outside leagues, and I'll get Steve to talk about what was achieved in New York City, I wound up getting people like Larry DeMar, Ed Boon, George Petro, and others, Brian Eddy, some of these names you may be familiar with. There's a place I guess it's Skokie, called Diversions. It was a game room. It was one of our test locations, and started a pinball league there to see, can I do it here? And Jason Wardrick, for anybody who follows the WPPR ratings and everything else, actually started as a video game player who saw us playing and said, what's going on? And he and his friend, who became game testers for a while for us for the video games, started playing in the league for the first time. It was the first time that they were exposed to it. So that was the birth of PAPA, then IFPA, following on the same way, but trying to come up with some way, some methodology that could kind of separate people out and have it be a level playing field. And more importantly, to Steve's point, because Steve did something remarkable that nobody has done since. He actually came up with regional tournaments, the fall flip-offs of 1993, that was around the country, going through distributors and everything else, leading up to an event that was in New York City. So, please.
Well, the well, we did. We did accomplish something that was never done before, and that was the regional flip-off tournaments. We did expose this to a lot of people. We did get a ton of news coverage. That was something that was really extraordinary. You can go back and look at it on YouTube and in a lot of other different places, especially at papa.org, which is supported by Kevin Martin, about the lore and the beauty of pinball. I was very satisfied and incredibly grateful to the people that were involved in these things back in the day and have gone out on their own and done a lot of work. I mean, Mr. McCoy Morris is sitting here, one of my original Papa players in one of my leagues, who does his own stuff. It's incredible that, you know, 20 years later, he's still at it and very enthusiastic about it, and does, has one of the best leagues in New Jersey, in Dunellen. He does that twice a year, right, Coy? And so on and so on. I mean, if you look around and I see the people that were involved back with me then that are sort of like out there still, it's just very, very rewarding, very satisfying that, you know, when you get the bug and you really understand what pinball is about, you just fall in love and you stay with it. I mean, it is a passion that I just possess today, that people walk in, they see me, and they ask me to, you know, I start talking, and, you know, they realize that I've bumped into a real insane person here, you know, I mean, because it's...
26th and 3rd, if I hadn't mentioned it before, is Modern Pinball NYC. All right, guys, we've kind of rambled. Wanted to open up the floor for a bit for any questions. It might have more merit than us just continuing to ramble. Questions? Yeah.
Wait.
Get you mic'd up.
Steve, Modern Pinball is a pay-per-time setup.
Yes.
What differences have you seen in running that kind of place versus a pay-per-game place? What have
That's
been your
great question. To begin with that, it took me quite a while to come be comfortable with the idea of not having a coin drop.
Understand and explain why. In New York, in terms of...
Well, in New York, the zoning is very prohibitive and extremely impossible to really open up a space that has any kind of amusement games of more than 9. So what we did was we came up with the concept of it being a retail space. We sell the games, and we also then charge an hourly fee. Now, you'll may be hearing from Rob Avento later, who started the Silver Ball Museum down in New Jersey in Asbury Park, another place that inspired me to go into this business, back into business. And he uses that model for himself, but he uses it for different reasons. We use it so that we could generate a receipt. And with that receipt, if you ever want to buy a pinball machine from us, you actually get full credit for whatever you spend. What has happened, and what has really been the most rewarding thing for me, is I realized that these younger kids that come in to play at $12 an hour that we charge is much more reasonable for a kid that has never played pinball, who's going to go and put a 75 cents into a game or even a dollar today and be done with it in 3 seconds. I mean, so the parents realize that it's an economical advantage. We have issues, obviously, with people that want to come in and not play for a half hour or an hour. And what we've been able to do is develop an actual ticket that is half of it, or two-thirds of it, is a 15% coupon. But we also have another part of it that you tear off, and it's worth one free game. So you can come in, you can play one free game. I mean, that's developed by my partner, Steve Zoller, who's quite an incredible marketing and internet developer. So that's part and parcel of how it all works. So that came later as we adapted to it. But I have found very little resistance from people paying up front for a limited amount of time.
Do you have trouble kicking them out after an hour?
Not at all. Not yet. What's been great to us
is... baseball bat helps.
No, not at all. You know, we're selling time. We're not time Nazis in a sense that we're not on top of people. If they spend an extra 10 minutes, it's fine. But if we notice that a regular customer is doing that more often than not, then we will address it. But we want people to enjoy the experience. We want pinball to be something that has no barriers to it. We create the games to be well lit. Everything functions incredibly well. I mean, it's something that you normally don't see in most locations. I mean, it's an tribute to Eddie Kramer, who's one of my techs, and Pat Velasci, who's also my other tech. And they work diligently, constantly, every day, maintaining these games. Because in reality, these are games that are pretty much 25 years old and up. And they're getting 700 to 1,000 plays a week. And that is something that we used to do at the Broadway Arcade. But at the Broadway Arcade, they were all new games because I was testing them. So basically, I was having a new game through there every 3 weeks. So they never got old. Now I'm dealing with older games that were new in my day and have to be maintained even more. So I got a little straight away from your question. But still, we haven't had that problem. People, I've always found respect. What you're doing is you give them the respect back. And that's how we do it there with the games the way they are. And I think people appreciate that.
Dave, did you have a question?
Yeah, I operate a small little arcade up in Buffalo now. We have our oldest game is a space shuttle. And she is probably rivaling some of the Stern games, including Steve's Star Trek, in income. What is the oldest game you have at Modern right now, and kind of numbers are you doing?
Thanks to my partner, Alan, who is an incredible collector. I think he's brought in a Gold Strike and a Bank Shot. So that's 70.
And the original Black Knight.
Original Black Knight came in, which I had to have. Steve, I just had to have it. I'm sorry. And Al helped us out with that as well. So, you know, it's a hand-in-hand type of thing, and it was different for us because we did say Modern Pinball. We got the name because we felt that it was important to differentiate between electromechanical and the modern era. Rob, who you might hopefully go to his seminar about museums, has set up a space in New Jersey with about 150 games, and mostly all of them are electromechanical, all working 50s, 60s, 70 games. Phenomenal experience. And we felt that we couldn't do justice to that, but I was wrong. The two games that have come in that we've been using over the last month get just as much play as the Metallica, the Star Trek, you know, and all the newer games.
You remember from your past, where's the new game, like from, you know, 5 years ago, no one comes in and goes, oh, I remember that, and that pulls my heartstrings. But people see Gold Strikes in there and they go, oh, wow, I remember that. Or I remember that, you know, a drop target game.
But, and you also asked your point about it, is it's much easier for a kid to play.
Yep. Any other? Rob? Got. Yeah.
For those of us who were not able to visit the Broadway Arcade back in the day, can you give us an idea of just how big the space was and how many pinballs you operated at
sure.
that time?
There was two, actually, Broadway Arcades. The first one that my dad started in 61 actually was 6,000 square feet, right on the corner of 52nd and Street and Broadway.
Counting downstairs, they had pool tables?
Yeah, 12,000 square feet.
Just checking.
Level.
Thank you.
In that space, when we were at the height of our pinball and video, I think we had 65 pinball machines and about 140 video games.
We had
and older games too. I mean, you know, the old diggers and the gun.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to think of the walls. There was wall. There was like six different distinct areas within this palatial setting. Not talking about the fresh nut counter in the front, posters, and whatever else. Six different distinct areas for the pinball machines. It was spectacular. It really was. Yes, and then you moved, And then you moved.
And then we moved.
Down the street.
Well, we had an issue where they actually built a physical hotel right on top of the building we were in, and we had some issues with New York City landlords.
So I have a question.
I got one more thing.
What year did you guys get married, and do Ellen and Sandra know about the affair?
They put up with us.
Yes, they do know.
And we spend more nights together than probably with our wives. But going back to what you were asking, in the smaller space, which was actually only 1,500 square feet, in that space, we had 14 pinball machines and 64 video games.
Right. And that's where the leagues were and everything else back when.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Yes, Rob.
I have a story for you, Steve. When I was a teenager, I went to Broadway Arcade, and it's the first time I got household for a $10 Rolex. That's the first story.
Yeah, probably did.
And also, I was curious about something else that you did, which I thought was really fun at the time. Tell us about the Brooke Shields event.
Brooke Shields. Well, Brooke Shields actually participated through one of our tournaments, the Papa tournaments. We did everything, Roger and I neglected to say, everything we've ever done with tournaments and competitive pinball has been involved with charity. That's a very important component to all this, to us.
Absolutely. Always has to be.
The Papa tournaments, the five of them that we did, raised over $120,000 for charity. Through the reasoning that we did one year have the Special Olympics, New York Special Olympics, as our charity, and that brought Brooke Shields to the space because she was a spokesman to it for it. Now, that was interesting because at the time she was rumored to be going out with Michael Jackson.
Right.
So how Papa worked was we had the tournament, then we had a dinner auction like Rob pretty much does here. And Brooke Shields was just mobbed with paparazzi because of tons of questions about that. But in fact, Brooke Shields is a pinball player.
Right.
And for her appearance, we got her a pinball machine, which she still has to this day.
Well, and the other interesting part to that particular Papa was that the cast from Tommy, which was on Broadway, also came that year. But we can talk about, again, Muhammad Ali, Paul Simon, Roberta Flack, John Hammond, Lou Reed. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, who were regulars coming in to play pinball and really supporting what Steve had created.
One more question.
Hi, this is real quick. You spoke briefly about the future of pinball. What about the future in terms of in international countries like China? Could you just say some of your experience or what you think will happen globally?
I mean, I'll respond to it. Mr. Horiguchi is going to be coming from Japan, and he's been taking care of things with TPO, Tokyo Pinball Organization, probably for the last 25, 30 years when he was part of Data East distributors and operators out there. I think that China poses an interesting opportunity for not just pinball, but for, you know, amusement games in general. I think when you see some of what the development is in their entertainment areas, if you will, I think that there's going to be something that we're going to see. I tend to equate it, and whether it's China or any other place, I tend to equate it with something that I've been involved with for the last 14 years, gaming, slot machines. Slot machines are finding their way into China, Japan, and other places in the Pacific Rim. I think that pinball will follow just as part and parcel to that for entertainment for a whole generation of players. So I feel very positive about it. Yeah. Yes,
Norbert. I'd like to come back on the comment, all the machines versus the new machines to operate. I come from Sydney, Australia. We are a little bit different. We are down under. My experience, we opened new location with 13 pinball machines in a place with no people. People thought of us that we are crazy. We brought a lot of machines and no people coming to the site. And we made that promise that we bring in people, and we are doing that. The pinball's actually getting people in, young people. It started with mid-30s, now it is mid-20s. People who never seen pinball machine. I got a lot of respect for modern pinball. You are our example. And I would like to actually create some partnership between your setup and our setup. We are called Pinball HQ. But coming back to the question, new versus old, we have Mustang, we have Star Trek, we have Metallica, we have all the new stand, including, lucky enough, we have The Walking Dead. So it was a big deal for us, of course. But we have also the older ones. The oldest is Funhouse. We have we have Whodunit and Adam's Family and Doctor Who, fantastic machines, Dirty Harry. We have Getaway. So we have about six old, I mean the 90s, and we have the very modern ones. Guess what? Mustang and Star Trek outperforms by far all of them.
There you go.
Every week we have six machines chosen every Wednesday for competition. Over 20 people come in. They always choose Mustang. They almost always choose Star Trek. And we are not talking about hardcore players. We're talking about casual players from local community. We're talking about people of different kind, different level of players, and they still choose the new. People like to see the new.
Always.
But saying that, yes, Funhouse is very popular. It's the hardest game to play over there. Everyone says that it's a bastard game, but they still pick it for competition. It's not earning as much as Mustang or Star Trek, but it's still doing well. So is Adam's Family and Doctor Who. So if I advise operators what to operate, come on, you know, in 90s, who operated 20 years old pinball machine? Nobody. Nobody would operate in 90s machines out of 70s. That's crazy. Is it crazy? That's crazy. It didn't exist. People operating new machines. You have to have new. If you thinking of becoming operator and you're thinking you can do it with old machines, then you'll be scratching your head like
myself. No, I think you can do it with a mix and a match. And I think the question and the challenge really is, and I know that we're running a little bit late, so my apologies, but I think the biggest challenge, maintenance. Maintenance and educating players as to what they can and can't play, and if they feel with some of the new games that there's an easier approach for them to play to get higher scores, yeah, I'd rather play Mustang than Funhouse. Funhouse is a tough game.
Games have minimum ball times, like the ball saves, so you get multi-ball. You're going to get multi-ball for 5 seconds, not like Funhouse. You lose a ball and it's gone, so you get that extra reward, I think, to the new. Hey,
David, go to the back.
If one comment I can make after being in this observational place I've been for the last 40 years is that no one likes every game. It's very subjective. And that's why we have so many talented designers doing a lot of different things. And, you know, what floats one person's boat doesn't float another one's. And then that's just the way it is. And that's why you do need diversity. That's why you do need to have a mix at all times.
I think it's why you have chocolate and vanilla ice cream. On that note, I know that Rob is itching, but David is pointing a finger at Kevin O'Connor. Yes.
Oh, a few minutes ago, you mentioned Brooke Shields and... Brooke Shields actually got incorporated into the artwork on a pinball machine. Does anybody know what pinball machine that was?
It was for the movie Tilt, but go ahead, guys.
No, it was not for the movie Tilt. Pardon? No, sir.
Yeah, no, not Barracuda.
No, sir. Jim, maybe you want to run a little contest or something. Okay, well, look around at Backlasses this weekend, and on Saturday, we'll see if you can come up with the answer at the autograph session. I'll give you a free KISS poster signed. How's that sound?
Right. There you go.
Thank you.
Martin. One thing I want to say to you guys, Roger, because you're the diplomat here, the ambassador of pinball, but I do business in China, and I've had people come to my home, and these are like older guys in their mid-20s up through their mid to late 30s, and they play pinball, and they have no idea. Their skill set is zero. So that's another battle you got is if you introduce to that country, they don't know what to do with it. They don't understand it. So you know, who would have guessed? But they just, that's not there. Guys, thank you so much for being with us.
Our pleasure.